So what's next for downtown after the dramatic failure of Lot J? Good Tuesday morning. We're live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, the civic group OurJax.com weighs in on what to do in the urban core after the Lot J deal went down to defeat. What do you think? Give us a call. It's 549-2937. Then later, the former head of the city's Kids Hope Alliance breaks his silence. We speak with Joe Peppers about his troubled tenure at the KHA and his thoughts on scandals at City Hall. But first this hour, the latest pandemic numbers. We are now at 1,579,281 cases in Florida. That's the cumulative count since the pandemic began. That's an 8,000 increase from Sunday. The death toll in the state is at 24,274. We say this every day. We'll say it again. Keep masking up, everybody, and wait your turn for those appointments. In Duval County, every Thursday at 5 o'clock, the County Health Department's website refreshes with new appointments, and there are other opportunities to get vaccinated popping up. We'll continue to update you on this program and on our website as much as we possibly can at WJCTnews.org on that very important public health imperative. Okay, after the Lot J project failed, what comes next for downtown Jacksonville? There are a number of other projects in the pipeline and no shortage of opinions. We're going to begin the hour with a closer look as we welcome David Miller, CEO of Brightway Insurance and Secretary of the Civic Group OurJax.com. Hi, David. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Good to have you. Also on the line, spokesperson for OurJax, attorney Audrey Moran. Hi, Audrey.
Good morning, Melissa.
And here's our question to callers. The Lot J deal didn't make it. So where should the city of Jacksonville invest in developing the urban core? Give us a call. It's 549-2937. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. And our Facebook page is open. Audrey Moran, if I could, I'd like to begin with you. You are the spokesperson for OurJax, a civic advocacy group which formed really in reaction to concerns about the direction of Jacksonville. You began your work when the effort to privatize JEA was really heating up. You weighed in on Lot J, expressing concerns about that. So your group is basically two for two now. You got what you wanted both times. The JEA deal didn't go through, and the Lot J deal didn't go through. So how are you, first of all, let me ask you, how are you feeling about things right now in the wake of how all of this has played out?
Well, I think what's important to remember is the pillars that OurJax was founded on, and that is integrity, accountability, and transparency in local government. We want Jacksonville to grow. We want Jacksonville to dream big. We want things to be happening in our downtown, like so many of the other citizens as well. But it has to be done in a smart way, in a way that's fair to taxpayers. And so we're feeling really good that the taxpayers were heard by what is now being called the Lot J7, the seven council members who stood up and said no. The Lot J deal was not a fair deal for taxpayers, and it needed to be done differently and done right. So if this, what we're hoping is we are on our way to creating a culture in government that values citizen input, is transparent, and understands that the citizens need to have trust in what's happening before they're going to be willing to invest.
Okay, so David Miller, then, with that imperative in mind, where do things go from here? How will OurJax direct its thought leadership, I guess you could call it, into the next phase for this city and how we should approach development in the urban core?
Well, the first part is we wanted to look internally, and we've recently added additional new, really impressive people to our advisory board, which we think is really important. You know, we speak for diversity of thought and engagement, and we feel we've got to exemplify that ourselves in our, you know, internally. I think, you know, one of the things that we saw, which was really so encouraging, were From JEA, we had around 500 people engaged. That went up to, in Lot J, somewhere upwards of 8,000 citizens who were engaged around Lot J. And we're seeing more and more citizens really saying, it's not a case, and where we're coming from, it's not a case of no, and we're certainly not an organization of no's. We're an organization that's going to advocate for yes, if. And yes, we do want smart development, but it should be done in a way that is helpful, is fair, does not create an unlevel playing field. And there are great opportunities for us to do all kinds of things. Certainly, it's great to embrace the Jaguars, and we want to do that in a smart partnership. But we also believe and know there are other developers around town who also want to be engaged in this process. And so, you know, those are some of the things we're
like
looking
who?
At now.
Like who?
Well, there, you know, I had a great conversation last night with one of our new board members, Steve Halverson, who used to be the chairman of Haskell. And you know, and that's what, you know, as a local government and local community, it's about having these community conversations with really smart people. We have so many great people, and empowering them. One of the things he said, yes, we need to have better ethics and legislation that speaks to that, you know, what we expect from ethical behavior, both in our government and lobbyists and special interests, and making sure that they're reined in. But we also need to make sure that we are thinking about how we can empower people and create the right incentives for all kinds of developers to invest in downtown, and how we say yes, and how we can give them the encouragement they need to think about how we're going to develop around all kinds of infrastructure that we have, and coming infrastructure like the Emerald Trail.
Like the Emerald Trail. We'll go to your calls in a moment for our Jacks. 549-2937, Audrey Moran. What about the Emerald Trail? What about the Jaguars now turning their attention to the downtown Shipyards and Metropolitan Park parcel on the north bank of the river? And what do you see as your group's role in the discussion about all of this?
Well, as you have said, the Jaguars have indicated they are turning the page on Lot J, at least for now, and in their words, going to focus on the shipyards. But I think what citizens need to understand is when they're talking about the shipyards, they're really talking about Metropolitan Park. And that is an issue for the Riverfront Parks Alliance, a group of organizations that is committed to making sure that we have our riverfront as accessible and open to the public as possible. And talking about what that riverfront is going to look like, whether it is the landing that is now a beautiful park on the riverfront, or Metropolitan Park, what is that riverfront going to look like, and how do we use that best? And what we stand ready to do is work with the Downtown Investment Authority, to work with city government to help open up that conversation and say, let's as a community think about what that looks like. Let's listen to what the Jaguars have in mind. Let's look at our parks as a whole and make a long-term plan. Helping to create conversation, helping to create transparency, getting citizens involved. That's what RJAX is all about, and we stand ready to help the administration and anyone else who's looking for assistance in engaging our community in prioritizing what's next.
Let us know your thoughts, everyone. How should the city invest? The Lot J deal went down to defeat dramatically in the Jacksonville City Council by one vote. If it had passed, the city would have spent hundreds of millions in taxpayer money on developing the parking lot next to TIAA Bank Field. Now things are changing, and there will be other priorities. What do you think they should be? 549-2937. Susan in Mandarin. Hi, Susan.
Yes, I specifically wanted to ask about Metropolitan Park because I thought I read that even the Downtown Investment Authority is talking about the Four Seasons Hotel building on the Metropolitan Park. And people are just saying it so easily, and I thought that park was created by grant money so that the park is supposed to be held in perpetuity. It seems to me, and I'd like your guest opinion on this, that giving away land that's supposed to be held in perpetuity as a park is a bad precedent. I mean, even if building the Four Seasons on it is a good idea, the precedent of letting developers think they can go around looking for parkland that they can develop on is a bad idea. And I also want to add that I love the website riverfrontparksnow.org. I don't know if that's what Audrey Moran was talking about or not, but they really have some awesome ideas. Thank you.
Thank you, Susan. All right, David Miller, a couple of things with Susan's points. One, in order for Shad Khan to realize his dream of developing a Four Seasons hotel and some other stuff on the North Bank, they would have to get permission to develop there because the city's agreement with the National Park Service was that that land was to be held as a park spot in perpetuity. In effect, they will have to do a land swap and create park space somewhere else. The other question, too, I think a lot of people have is a Four Seasons viable, a high-end hotel like that, a viable proposition for Jacksonville? Can it succeed? What are your thoughts?
Well, I don't think there's a question that we can support a high-end hotel in Jacksonville as we continue to grow, and that sort of thing. But the real question here is the question that was brought up by Susan, who called in. It's, what do we want our future to be? What do we want development to look like? Right now, what we do is we wait for someone to come with a big idea, and we react to those ideas. That's not the best way to think about how we're going to develop our downtown and reach our potential. Far better would be to engage the community and all kinds of smart folks around who have different ideas, great ideas, visionary ideas of what a master plan could be for downtown. We have a lot of and done a lot of these types of plans in the past, but they tend to start and fail as administrations transition. But we really need to take ownership of this as a community, and instead of hoping that the administration, whichever administration it is going to lead us, we need to have a longer-term vision than 4 or 8 years and think about what's the kind of development that is going to, perhaps take much longer to develop, but be very intentional, because once we develop these properties, those assets are gone and off the table. We have a really unique opportunity now with the amount of available riverfront space and downtown availability to really transform what is possible. And so I think being deliberate about that, engaging the community as we're trying to do around those conversations, I think is really helpful. And we're going to continue to engage in that activity.
Audrey Moran, the Daily Record is reporting that the Downtown Investment Authority is going to issue an RFP actually tomorrow for public park space designs at the former Jacksonville Landing site. They will select three firms that will submit designs for a 4.5-acre riverfront park / plaza. This is going to be renamed Riverfront Plaza. So this would theoretically be a public park on the waterfront. And so this is a new wrinkle in all of this. There are a lot of moving parts to what's happening. And let me get you to follow up as well on some feedback we're getting from our listeners. Here's a comment on Facebook. Is our Jax a pay-to-play group? Why do they need to represent the feelings of the city and residents? We don't need more well-heeled folks telling the poor people of Jacksonville what they need. So some criticism of RJAX. What's your response to that?
Well, Melissa, we are all about getting diverse points of view out in the open, transparency in government, and making sure the citizens are heard. And the citizens are not always going to agree on everything. What we are more about is process, making sure that the citizens' voice, yay or nay, is part of a conversation when we're spending millions of taxpayer dollars. So, no, we don't presume to speak for every single person in Jacksonville. What we do presume is that most people, if not all, want a government that is built on integrity, transparency, and accountability, and that that process is very important. I also think one of the things about Lot J that was fascinating is you saw a tremendous amount of passion, a tremendous amount of will that people said, I am going to be heard. People who had never spoken at city council meetings before showed up. And that was on the Lot J deal. On riverfront parks, on our parkland, that is an area where Jacksonville citizens are incredibly passionate. You'll recall a couple of years ago when there was some talk about swapping out Julington Creek Durban Preserve for some land on Black Hammock, and the community went wild with objections and comments and saying, no, we're not going to let that happen. So your caller from Mandarin is touching on something that we as a community are so proud to be a city of parks, to have more parkland than any other city in the continental United States. And I think making sure if we are doing anything with parks in this city, we need to be making sure the process is open, transparent, and has community engagement. Riverfront Parks Now is an amazing group of organizations that are passionate about parks. We need to be bringing everyone to the table, having a conversation, whether it is the landing site, the Metro Park site, or any of our other riverfront parks, and making sure we do this, as David Miller said, for the long haul, not for the short term.
The website that you referred to is riverfrontparksnow.org. To learn more about that civic effort, here's a tweet from John. The city needs to stop exclusively backing home run projects backed by politically connected movers and shakers. Look to the smaller players who are moving forward with good, productive projects downtown without relying on the largesse of seemingly corrupt leaders. David Miller, our Jax was honestly formed in reaction to that perception that big decisions in this city are controlled by a very small number of, frankly, they're oligarchs. They've been called the syndicate by critics of people who operate in the shadows and have outsized influence on these massive taxpayer-funded moves. And so do you see yourselves as representing the grassroots in this sort of really revolt, taxpayer revolt against not only the JEA privatization attempt, but also this deal?
Well, I'll tell you, that listener hit a bullseye. It is they have identified something that is the same thing that we have identified, and that is we have what really is all of these things we've seen are really symptoms. You know, whether it was JEA, Lache, they are symptoms. They are not the problem. The problem is this culture that we have found ourselves in where individuals use and try to use the mechanism of a government to benefit themselves rather than other individuals flexing their muscles to speak for the common good and create policies that are and procedures and that sort of thing that are going to lift everyone up, that are smart uses of our money, that aren't designed to give special advantages to certain people where we're using the taxpayer dollars to essentially line people's pockets and pick winners. What we need to do is have a government that really encourages a level playing field. And when you talk about rewarding the folks who have been here in our community or attracting new business, that's what they want. They don't want to feel like they, you know, when I come to Jacksonville, what lobbyists do I need to engage so I can get my project through? That's the wrong kind of thinking, and that's the kind of behavior that we do need to rid ourselves of. What we are absolutely committed to.
A comment on our Facebook page from Catherine Tapuni. She writes, Tampa, whose river is a tiny fraction the size of the St. John's River, has had success with developing their riverfront, including their shipyards. It's now called the Channelside District. They have open park space directly on the water and a river walk. They repurposed the old waterworks building into a restaurant. They have a children's water park, tons of open space for pickup football and frisbee. Go any weekend to see how well-used and accessible it is to everyone. Find out what resources they have tapped into and how they approached planning. Audrey Moran, what about looking to the examples of other cities? Certainly, you've been on some of these Chamber of Commerce trips that are sent out for that very reason, to learn the success stories of other cities and bring them back here.
Absolutely right. There is no reason to reinvent the wheel, whether we're looking at Tampa or Oklahoma City or Chattanooga. What they have done with their riverfront is nothing short of spectacular. And we also know that developing riverfront has tremendous return on investment, huge economic development. And we've got studies that show that. Riverfront Parks now is part of the, is looking at the economic development that could come to Jacksonville if we had a really intense, purposeful effort to develop our riverfront parks. So Catherine hit it on the head. Tampa did it. Chattanooga did it. We can do it. We need to do it, though, in a way that is transparent, that engages lots of different ideas and developers, and that we commit as a community to take the 5-10 years it's going to take to get there and demand that our elected officials follow that plan.
Thank you both for your thoughts this morning. David Miller, Audrey Moran, both with the civic group OurJax.com. Thanks for your time.
Thanks, Melissa.
All right, much more coming up on the show later in the hour. Phase 8 Theater is serving up a delicious Valentine's Day treat. We'll tell you about it. But up next.
I remember meeting the head of IG once, and she described Jacksonville as the Wild Wild West.
An extended conversation with Joe Peppers, the former head of the city's Kids Hope Alliance. We'll be right back.
Baptist Health and Wolfson Children's Hospital are here for children in or at risk of a mental health crisis. Our 24/7 Kids and Teens helpline is staffed by mental health experts and available to parents, kids, and teens. Call 904-202-7900.
Need more British in your life? WJCT is offering BritBox and PBS Passport for $14.90 a month. Binge the very best of drama and comedy programming they have to offer. Sign up today at jacksbundle.com.
Welcome back. He resigned under fire last year after a troubled tenure leading this city's flagship child welfare agency. Joe Peppers, the former head of the city's Kids Hope Alliance, is now breaking his silence about his time working for the city of Jacksonville and scandals swirling around the Eleni Curry administration. I spoke with Peppers. Take a listen. Hi, Joe. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me. Good morning.
Well, it's been almost a year since you resigned from Jacksonville's Kids Hope Alliance. And so as someone who left a public agency in Jacksonville amid controversy, it will be interesting to get your thoughts about the recent city council report that was released into another municipal controversy here, the failed attempt to sell JEA and the ouster of JEA CEO Aaron Zahn over that whole affair. You've watched all of this play out from a distance because you've gone back to the private sector. What are your thoughts about how this has all played out in this city?
Well, I think it's par for the course. There was something that the lawyer of Mr. Zahn put out to affect a, I want to say that it said it's something to the effect of it was preordained, and that's absolutely true. There's no getting around it. You probably can't necessarily prove it. It'll be interesting to see what Aaron says in court. And I don't know about the pup, but the plan all along was for sure to sell JEA. And that's
you,
pretty obvious.
You believe he was brought in to make that happen?
I don't know that he was brought in to make that happen, but I know that that was part of, that was one of the main objectives, is for sure, was to sell JEA, and largely because the city doesn't have enough money to do things like Lot J. And so it was absolutely a talk, a conversation that was circulating amongst the administration. And I know Aaron was supposed to execute that mission. I don't know how he got distracted with the pup and all that other stuff, but for sure, JEA was supposed to be sold in order to facilitate tearing down the jail, Lot J, all these other things that they had in mind.
Now, you left the Kids Hope Alliance after an inspector general's office investigation into workplace misconduct that focused on you. They announced this investigation into you a day after the Florida Times Union reported that you had authored a memo accusing the city's chief administrative officer, Brian Hughes, and another Curry administration official of exerting undue influence on you to steer grant money to preferred organizations. What's your reaction to the eventual IG report that came out? It focused a lot on your personal conduct, but not so much on your accusations into Jacksonville City Hall.
Yeah, I mean, most of the findings for the IG report, I sort of found comical, to be honest with you. I remember meeting the head of IG once, and she described Jacksonville as the wild, wild west. And so I was a little alarmed, but I knew that they were going to smear me. I knew that they were going to talk about my personal life and my relationships. And so I wasn't surprised by that. I was very surprised, and I almost thought it was laughable that they would suggest that I try to steer grants to people that I knew, because that just was fundamentally not true. And I thought it was also interesting, the wordplay that they used, and just particularly the TV media, how they sort of spun it. I mean, it was obviously intentional, but I'm not surprised. I mean, look, they're going to smear people that don't enable them. They're going to smear people that push back, and quite frankly, you know, there was parts of my personal life that were out of control, and so. But at the end of the day, the people that were in that room in August of 2018, they know exactly what they said. They know exactly what they suggested, and I didn't make that up. And the fact that I had to go to the links I did to document what happened I didn't write that article a year later. I wrote it within days, and I talked to several people. I showed them my phone records of who I talked to. And so I was a little surprised that it just sort of was blown off as like, oh, this is just something that I was trying to make up.
Now, you took the job running the Kids Hope Alliance coming from a job at Amazon. Since leaving the city of Jax, you've gone back to Amazon. At the time, your hire was criticized by those who felt you weren't really qualified to run KHA. When Aaron Zahn was appointed CEO of JEA, the same criticism was levied against him that he was being put into place without the proper qualifications. He has now been forced out. You have left your post. Another individual, Ryan Ali, was tapped to lead the city of Jacksonville's sports and entertainment division. An inspector general investigation was opened into his conduct in the workplace, and he has now left that position. So under Mayor Curry's tenure, three different high-profile hires have been made to run important city agencies, and all three have left amid accusations that either the individuals weren't qualified or that they were, at least in the case of Aaron Zahn, pursuing another agenda that City Hall hadn't been transparent about. And so as we await the federal grand jury results into the JEA affair. What are your thoughts about that grand jury investigation and the way this administration has hired people for important posts, since you had firsthand experience going through this yourself and you suffered professionally as a result?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because as a black man and as a Democrat, I really sort of saw this as an opportunity to really help young black kids or young black and brown kids or poor kids. And I, you know, I sort of stand on my resume. I feel like having worked at Amazon and Apple and having worked in the military, which is the biggest nonprofit in the world, I really thought that I could do the job. But more than that, I think that the profile that the administration looks for is someone who is an enabler. And, you know, if you just look at the current political climate in America, you're seeing, you know, it's binary, right? It's either zeros or ones. So you're looking for people who will be loyal or loyalists to you. And I don't know that you can run an organization where you're underfunding and not supporting kids or any of these other organizations without having some strong personalities. And I don't think that that's what they wanted. I remember someone telling me that you need to make sure that you're ready because they're going to tell you exactly what to do. You need to be checking in with them all the time. And I remember pushing back on that, and they were like, listen, this is just the way it is. And this is another city leader. And so there is a method of leadership, of intimidation, of marginalization, that's very clear. It's very clear in the Republican Party. And so this administration looked for enablers that would push their agendas. And if they didn't push their agendas, or if they offered any pushback, or if they talked back, then they would be marginalized. And so I suspect that the investigation, the grand jury investigation and whatever else is going on with JEA, is going to shed some additional light on that. But everything that we've seen in the city the last, since 2015, since Curry's been elected, all the smoke, a lot of that is true. A lot of that is true. There is a sense that in the administration that I feel that many of the council members are idiots or that they're just pawns. They're just,
where did you get that perception?
Oh, just the way they talk, just the way they talk about people, just the way that the conversations that were had, the way that folks would be discussed. I was at a birthday party, and I get text messages from members of the administration about why I'm out with Garrett Dennis. And quite honestly, Garrett Dennis is one of 19 city council members.
He's a city council member, a Democrat, and a critic of the mayor.
Right.
Okay.
Right. And so, you know, that really, for me, caters to people's loyalty, and either you're for them or you're against them. And so for someone like me who wanted to help and who has a military background, I felt that I had to demonstrate loyalty and be over the top even with it. And in retrospect, I mean, that was foolish. I should have really thought long and hard about just as a Democrat, like I just didn't support the ideology of the administration. And two, I really assumed positive intent, and I shouldn't have. I should not have, because at the end of the day, I was an enabler, and it was a toxic culture. It's a toxic culture there. And so, I mean, just the examples of like, we would be in a, they have these meetings, these board meetings with all of the directors. And one of the meetings after the second term was won, we were told to cancel all Florida Times Union subscriptions. If you have a Florida Times Union subscription in your organization, make sure you cancel it. And so that's the kind of behavior that we were seeing. It was always us against them. Incredibly negative talk about people that work in the nonprofit community. And so I just think it's toxic culture, and I think that you're going to see a lot of that. I think it's going to be hard to prove because they do a good job of moving in the shadows, but at the end of the day, you're going to see and more proof of a toxic culture, and the hiring of people who don't have a lot of experience is sort of a way to get your own people in that will be loyal to you. And that's really what the effort was around that.
Joe Peppers, a former head of the Kids Hope Alliance, thank you for joining us today.
All right, thank you for having me.
Well, there is a new eco-friendly drinking straw out on the market, and it could be a viable option for businesses that are seeking alternatives to plastic straws. Now, this straw is called Fade, and it was created by WinCup, which has a manufacturing facility right here in Jacksonville. It's the focus of today's Going Green. Brad Laporte is CEO of WinCup, Inc., and he's on the line right now. Hey, Brad, good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. How are you today?
I'm great, thanks. And it's good to hear about this from you. So these are new straws, eco-friendly and easy to use, and they're called Fade, and that's spelled P-H-A-D-E. Tell us about this product.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me on. I'd love to talk about Fade. So Fade is really a groundbreaking technology using PHA, polyhydroxyalkanoates. Actually, the material itself is built by and designed by Danimer Scientific just in South Georgia. We had spent about a year and a half developing this material and commercializing this material and making it into a drinking straw. What's interesting about it is it performs and looks and feels just like a traditional straw, but when it ends up at its end of life, it turns back into organic material.
So it looks so people don't have to feel that they're drinking something that they don't necessarily want to use, like a paper straw. Those are not really well loved by a lot of consumers. This is like a plastic straw, but less harmful to the environment. Is that right?
That's correct. It's actually created through fermenting of canola oil, and we take the Danimer takes that polymer, creates it into a usable material that we turn into a straw. It doesn't get soggy, doesn't crack or split. It performs just like a regular straw. We don't condone littering or whatnot. We want you to dispose of it properly. We'd like you to compost it in your backyard or a composting facility. And in any environment, it turns back into natural organic material.
So when you use a Fade straw, can you throw it in the trash? Should you throw it in the recycling bin? What should you do to make sure that it composts or that it degrades properly?
We prefer that you put it in either a home composting pile or an industrial composting pile. But reality is, if you throw it in the trash, wherever it ends up, it'll still break down. The key technology here is bacteria. So any environment that has bacteria will break down this product.
And can you talk a little bit about why it's important to phase out plastic straws? They're particularly harmful, Brad. Can you explain that a little bit?
Yeah, so the reality is that only 10% of plastic actually gets recycled in the U.S., and 36% of plastic material actually gets disposed of properly. So plastic straws are a particularly difficult part of that because they're so small and they don't typically get disposed of properly. So they end up in landfills or they end up in the environment, and they stay around for hundreds of years as a fossil fuel, traditional plastics. The great thing about Fade is within a matter of months, it's gone.
Hmm. So how can people use Fade straws? Are you testing them out anywhere locally?
Yes. We have Fade is at the Ponte Vedra Inn and Beach Club locally there in Ponte Vedra. A few other spots there in Jacksonville, the Conch House, the Caps in the Water. And then recently, your neighbor over in Orlando, Fade was just been spotted on a restaurant on a Disney property. So we're growing. We're distributing nationally. Actually, Dunkin' Brands is testing Fade in about 250 to 300 of their stores, some in the Southeast as well. So we're growing, and what we're super excited about is all of this development and where Fade was born was right there on Fifth Street in Jacksonville.
But you have big plans for this. Wind Cup has a national reach. Tell us about your rollout for Fade and a little bit more about your company and your sustainability vision.
Sure. Absolutely. Great. Thanks. Great question. So Wind Cup's been a major food service supplier for a very long time. In the last few years, we have really turned our focus into developing eco-friendly products. We have Vio, which is a biodegradable foam product. Fade, obviously, is our first step into PHA and the canola oil product. And we have huge plans to expand that technology. We have multiple products being developed now to continue to eliminate the fossil fuel footprint and the issue that we have with, you know, plastics in the water, plastics in the ocean, plastics in the, you know, litter that stays around for a long time. You know, Fade is really that solution to pollution.
So we're talking what? Straws, cups, lids, clamshell containers for food that are normally made out of plastic, that kind of thing?
What's interesting with our partners at Danimer, we have not been able to find something yet that we've not been able to make with PHA, which is really exciting. There's really no, doesn't seem to be any limitations other than, you know, the technology is young, the capacity is small, and we're continuing to grow it. Now, Danimer has plans to expand into a greenfield and pumping, you know, 100 million pounds of this product to be able to use to replace traditional fossil fuels.
Wow. So in the meantime, people can order your products for their business or even for their personal use at home, right? Can that be done?
Absolutely. If you go to fadeproducts.com, there's a buy button. You can go order Fade for your restaurant or bar, or if you want to use them at home, absolutely. We actually did a recent campaign where we gave away Fade straws, and we had over 150,000 in a short 5-day period, 150,000 folks or straws that we gave away as part of our National Straw Day campaign.
Nice. So order your eco-friendly straws, everybody, at fadeproducts.com, P-H-A-D-E, products.com. Also, our producer, Heather Schatz, wrote about Fade straws and other eco-friendly packaging that you can tap into in the new sustainable issue of Edible Northeast Florida. Look for that on newsstands across town this month. And thanks so much, Brad. He's Brad Laporte, CEO of Wind Cup, Inc. Their manufacturing facility is based right here in Jacksonville. Thanks for being the star of our Going Green today, Brad.
Thank you, Melissa. Thanks for having me on.
And in a moment, Phase 8 Theater has something delicious cooking up for this Valentine's Day. We'll go on to their virtual stage for their production, The Food of Love. That's next.
Announcing Vickers Landing at Oak Bridge, bridging retirees with an all-new Ponte Vedra Beach community featuring new homes, a resort lifestyle, and services tailored for active retirees. Information at VickersLanding.com.
Escape to a world of British telly on BritBox and PBS Passport when you become a supporter of WJCT. Sign up at JacksBundle.com today.
On the next Fresh Air, an important chapter in women's and medical history, Elizabeth Blackwell and her times. In the 1840s, Blackwell got into a lesser-known medical school when the male students decided it would be an entertaining prank to admit her. But she was no joke. Our guest will be Janice Nomura, author of a new book about Blackwell. Join us.
Today at noon on WJCT News 89.9. The national unemployment rate is 6.7%, but individual states and towns have different rates and different challenges.
Our town has been dramatically changed, and we're looking at a tough 5 years ahead of us.
I'm Rima Reis, from Hawaii to Nebraska to Florida, zooming in on three economies. That is next time on Marketplace.
Tonight at 6 on WJCT News 89.9.
Young Americans made their mark on the election, turning out in record numbers and making an impact in key states. Polls suggest they've set a high bar for the new administration. What matters most to them? And how do you keep a generation engaged when trust in institutions is cratering across America? We'll find out next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. Well, Jacksonville's Phase 8 Theater created a romantic hit for Valentine's Day a few years ago. Their production, The Food of Love, was written by local talents, and it tells a romantic story. But here's the really cool part. They paired the theater with some delicious dinner that accompanies the story. This year, The Food of Love is going virtual, but you can still enjoy this live theater production and enjoy a great meal at the same time. To find out how, I spoke with one of the show's creators, Kelby Siddons. Kelby, thanks so much for being with us. Good morning.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
So it's been a crazy year for arts and entertainment and live theater, but people can rejoice in that what's becoming a Valentine's Day tradition for Jacksonville is on at Phase 8. It's The Food of Love by you and Andre D. Bravo. Now, this was a sold-out show that you started a couple of years ago. Tell us about The Food of Love and what you have planned.
Sure. So The Food of Love has traditionally been a dinner theater experience that we staged live at Mocha in their cafe area. Obviously, the times they have changed, it would not be safe to enjoy that immersive dinner theater in that way. So we are presenting what we call Dinner Theater to Go. We have adapted the story, which is based on Cyrano de Bergerac by Edmond Rostand, for an audio-only experience. So it's akin to radio theater. It really should be an NPR lover's dream.
Wow.
And we have partnered with local food trucks to still cater the experience so you can pick up or have delivered this five-course meal that the characters in the show are also discussing and enjoying during the action. So you have this sensual experience despite enjoying the story from a distance as you're eating the same food that the characters are talking about and that drives the tale.
Oh, wow. So people just need to listen then to the show through your website while they eat. Is that right?
Exactly. So we have on our website now, you can purchase a stream for the show that's going to premiere on February 13th. That's Valentine's Saturday. You can listen to it through the end of the month. But on that day, February 13th, local chefs Wesley Noguera and Jody Petronella have at their food trucks available for pickup or delivery bœuf bourguignon and, you know, beautiful salad and a decadent dessert, which is lemon blueberry bread pudding. And all of these are drivers in the story, which we call a queer gourmand take on Cyrano de Bergerac.
Now tell us about the plot of The Food of Love. It is a takeoff on the classic Cyrano de Bergerac tale, but with some modern tweaks. Yeah?
Yes. Yes, indeed. So instead of two suitors that are pursuing the beautiful, lovely, intelligent Roxanne through poetry, one of them being very handsome and kind of the face and the other providing the intelligence behind that, in our version, the seduction happens with food. So you have a chef, and the element that's really important to us about this is that it is a queer love story. So in this year's iteration, our chef, Alex Ragno, he is trans, and he is unsure about how to talk to this woman that he knew as a girl when they were at summer camp together. And so he allows Chris, this handsome man that Roxanne encounters in the cafe where Alex works to pass off this beautiful cooking as his own. But in fact, it's Alex who's behind the scenes pining for Roxanne, and eventually the food and the situation is going to reveal him, and we have a triumphant queer love story for Valentine's Day 2021.
Very nice. Now, this is something people can enjoy over Valentine's weekend, but leading up to that, you have something else related to the Food of Love, an audio storytelling masterclass that you are offering. Tell us about that.
Yes. So our cast of four actors, we have our trio in the love triangle and then also a narrator. They did some training before starting to rehearse and record with a Chicago-based full-time voice actor, Lindsay Dorcas. And so they took her workshop. It was fantastic. And if other folks would like to take a workshop with Lindsay, they can do so before the show happens. So on February 7th, from 4 to 7 p.m., we have a couple of levels of access. Whether you want a lot of coaching on performance or you just want an introduction and to glean her expertise, this whole form of audio storytelling and radio theater is something that we're very excited to dive into and explore in new and safe ways during this pandemic moment.
Well, check it all out at Phase 8 and spell out EIGHT, phase8.org, The Food of Love by Kelby Siddons and Andres Di Bravo. It's their third return of their sold-out annual Valentine's event. It's dinner in five courses, theater in five acts. Pre-order the food and stream the radio adaptation at phase8.org, premiering Saturday, February 13th. And we'll run through February. So kudos to you, Kelby. It sounds really romantic and fun and creative, too. So have fun with it.
Thank you. Thank you. Hope to not see you at the show, but hear the show with you.
Pretty cool. Old style radio theater back for the 21st century. That's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Heather Schatz. Josh Torres is show director. Our news director is Jessica Palumbo. Bill Bortsfield is our digital editor. Keep your feedback coming. Send those emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. You can also catch our rebroadcast tonight at 8 on this radio station. And our podcast is up later today, wherever you listen, on our website. And also, listen anytime to the shows and other content through the WJCT app. I'm Melissa Ross. This is First Coast Connect on WJCT News 89.9 Jacksonville. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great Tuesday.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.